Hello, welcome, and thank you for downloading the Missouri Review podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in sunny Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of stories, poems, essays, and interviews from authors featured in both our print and online editions. On today's podcast, we are proud to present Anna Solomon reading from her story, The Long Net. Her reading was recorded live at the 2011 Editor's Prize Weekend, which was held at the Cherry Hill Conference Center in Columbia, Missouri. Anna was introduced by the managing editor, Michael Nye.
Because it was Christmas and New Year's Eve, travel and holiday plans, all that good stuff. And then last night, I talked to Anna about my problems with my agent, my problems with shopping for a home, and her unsolicited advice has helped me tremendously already this morning. So I now go to Anna for everything that I need. Confidence, generosity, kindness, and a little bit of terror are all things that we find in her prize-winning story, The Long Net. To greatly oversimplify, this story is about June, our narrator, remembering the summer she was 10 years old, and she and her friend Tammy were lured by a photographer in a nearby trailer park into taking pornographic photos. And this is hidden, always, from her mother, who spends her time in her beautiful garden mourning the graves of Tammy's two brothers, who were stillborn. In the Meet the Author section of Anna's story, she says of The Long Net, it's also just a story about a girl heading out into the woods behind her house to see what she might find. And that's such a wonderfully true and mysterious way to think of June's story. Anna describes, to me anyway, a fairy tale. A dark fairy tale, perhaps, a Grimm's fairy tale, one with twists and subject matter that can turn gruesome and violent. So much of what is horrible in The Long Net is off the page, isn't shown to us as readers, but felt in the way the narrator reveals, evades, shadows her story. These movements of time and emotion, barely and yet skillfully controlled, are what makes this such an engaging, devastating story. Like a painter, there is an awareness of how the smallest gestures will color, shade, and form what we see in the subtext of June's story, and stays in our mind long after we close the magazine. Anna Solomon received her MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She is the recipient of a Pushcart Prize, and her stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Georgia Review, One Story, Harvard Review, and many other fine journals. Anna lives in Providence, Rhode Island with her husband and daughter, and her first novel, The Little Bride, is forthcoming from Riverhead in September 2011. Please give a warm welcome to our prize winner in fiction this year, Anna Solomon.
And I love thinking about this as a fairy tale, which I hadn't until now. I want to thank Jeffrey E. Smith for his generosity and the entire staff of the Missouri Review for their attention and warmth. I especially want to thank Evelyn Rogers, who's been reading and rejecting my stories for it takes a special touch to pass on a story without passing on a writer. I think John mentioned this earlier. And it takes a remarkable intelligence to edit as well as Evelyn does. My story, called The Long Neck, as Michael mentioned, is about a young girl named June who runs into some trouble at a campground one summer. I'm glad he mentioned the aspect of the mother and the stillborn babies, because I've actually, in the interest of time, basically cut that thread out of my reading tonight. I just don't have time for it. So in the interest of time, I've focused this reading on her adventures with her friend Tammy Renata. But for the full story, I hope you'll read it. Can you hear me in the back?
No.
What if I talk like this? Do you want the mic?
Do you want the mic back?
No. It's just that like, yeah.
Okay. But I'm the only one who seems to want it. Mics are good. Technology.
Right. I know it's too. Massachusetts. Most of my friends were off at camp or occupied with sailing lessons or whatever other private school pursuits my parents deemed would interfere with a child's imagination and resourcefulness. They could not have said that they didn't have the money and that I was already on scholarship for school. They thought of themselves as having the money and just choosing not to use it. I was not allowed to go to the beach for fear of sunburn, but I was allowed, for reasons that must have been grounded in progressive educational theory, to wander into the woods behind our house, which were large and dark, and which led, eventually, if you went all the way up the hill and back down the other side, out onto the asphalt steps of Schultz's sunny campground. Can you hear me now, Craig? Schultz's was not the kind of campground my parents had taken me to up in Maine, with tent sites and fire pits spread out beneath pine trees. It was owned by Tammy Renata's family, who notoriously fought to build an amusement park on the old Dryden land and lost, and whose clientele stayed in RVs and camper trailers. The Renatas lived at the campground, too. Most people called them the Schultzes, which was Tammy's mother's maiden name, and also the name of Tammy's grandmother, who ran the campground and who was called by everyone Boogie. I knew Tammy from soccer league, the only part of my life where I met public school kids. I barely considered her a friend except in summer when I was lonely. My father had told me never to feel lonely, but I did. He said loneliness was the result of boredom, and boredom meant you weren't taking responsibility for your gifts. So on top of my loneliness, there was a certain shame. If I arrived early enough at the campground, I was invited down into Bobby's cool parlor for a late breakfast of hot dogs. The Schultz women were fat, but Tammy and her sister Gloria were skinny like their father, who did most of the work at Schultz's, and because Tammy's mother resented her girls for this, she was always sending them to Bobby's finished half basement to be fattened up. I had never entertained the notion that hot dogs might qualify as food or that one might eat them indoors, free of bun and relish. On Bobby's fine china, lolling naked in their glistening oil alongside potato chips and a pond of ketchup, they were terrifying. Two each we were served, like two fingers or two penises, of which I knew nothing except that they might be a little like hot dogs. As I chewed, I tried not to touch them with my tongue and not to gag. But they'd been handled by a woman called Booby without forks or tongs, repulsed me further. I was Unitarian Universalist, raised to believe in my own capacity for compassion, tolerance, even love if necessary, but Tammy's life seemed to me an undeniably crude thing. I was drawn to it as one is drawn to lives that appear poorer than one's own. So there I would find myself well before lunchtime while Bobby trolled the perimeters of the table in her orthopedic sneakers and the rest of the room stretched out around us in a permanent, disorienting dusk. Tammy and I sat close together, though we were not close. She and Gloria ate quickly and without pleasure, finishing their pile of fat just as skinny as before. Then Gloria, who was older, went off in a golf cart to stock the canteen while Tammy watched me swallow the remainder of my hot dogs. I had the urge once or twice to stare back at her rudely and say, "That's not very polite." But there was something about Tammy's look. It was the same quietly stunned expression she got on the soccer field just before you passed her the ball, as if she'd never seen one before. She had this dumbness about her. Even when she trapped the ball and took off down the field and scored, which she did more often than any other girl, you couldn't quite reconcile any of that with what you saw when you looked at her face. When we finished at Bogey's, we went up to the canteen, where Gloria would have finished stocking and gone off in the golf cart to some other business, and where Mrs. Schultz reigned at the register. She was bigger than her mother. Her body seemed to lie on the counter more than sit behind it. Her eyes, buried in her cheeks, lit up when they saw us. Somewhere beneath her knees, Mrs. Schultz kept a special box of candy bars, and as we approached, she slid two in our direction. Three Musketeers, she would say, or Mars, which sounded like Maz in her towny accent. There was no question in her voice, only a little trill, a mild hysteria at her own power. And so on top of the hot dogs and potato chips went the chocolate and nuts and caramel. Mrs. Schultz watched us with salivatory satisfaction. Then she took the wrappers from our hands, dropped them somewhere beneath her knees, and held her fat palm across the counter. She made us eat, then she made us pay. Afterward, Tammy and I would sit nauseously on the concrete step of the store, staring down the hill at the marsh in the distance and at the highways beyond that, and right in front of us at a small wooden shed which held her father's various tools and machines. Mr. Renato was a neat man, and his shed, with its rows of sharp, clean utility, each wrench or saw positioned within its magic marker outline on the wall, felt like a sad place in all its order. Maybe Tammy had her own way of seeing it, but one noontime in late July, when the heat was intense enough to make your knees sweat, we were sitting there digesting, and she said, "You know the strangest thing to think about? Your parents didn't even know each other once. Most of their lives, they didn't even know each other." I gave Tammy a sideways, disapproving look meant to convey that she was the strangest thing and that my mind was occupied with more pressing concerns. I didn't want to think about my parents not knowing each other any more than I wanted to think of them having sex, which meant I wanted not to think about it so badly I started thinking about it. I pictured my father on a green at Harvard where he'd gone for his graduate degree, and my mother in her parents' house where she lived after college until she married my father. I couldn't see their young faces. I couldn't make their bodies move or say anything. It was a little like thinking about how there was no end to the universe. Your brain tried to stretch that far, then slammed into a wall. The asphalt was hissing, my stomach hurt. I was grateful when Mrs. Schultz called, "Go do something with yourselves. You got your own television set, for Christ's sakes." Mrs. Schultz had been shouting some version of this all summer. Usually we followed her advice and walked back to Tammy's house, where we watched daytime television and performed various makeovers and operations on Tammy's sweet-smelling My Little Ponies. But on that day of our trying to fathom our parents before they were our parents, like half people or undone puzzles, in our disturbance we moved toward the shed, and the only object which lay askew, a hand dolly Gloria had left on its side after her morning stocking. Tammy picked it up and started to lean it against the wall. Then she paused and looked at me. "We could start a business," she said. I laughed. "Doing what?" "Selling ice." "That's a stupid idea," I said. Tammy nodded as if she agreed, then said, "The generators keep going out. All these campers," she pointed a finger and swept her spinning arm in a circle above her head. "Their AC is out, their fridges are out, they're using coolers, they need ice." I tried and failed to find the flaw in Tammy's logic. "Fine," I huffed, "but it's still a stupid idea, and I get to push the dolly." She handed me the dolly without resistance. Tammy was like that, obedient in a way that took the wind out of your sails. Her thin jaw hung open slightly as she waited for me to lead the way back into the canteen, where Mrs. Schultz loaned us a cooler and our first batch of ice, with the agreement that we'd pay her back plus 15% interest. The campground was a rundown, quiet place. There were pinwheels turning and older couples strolling here and there, but there wasn't much of what my mother suspiciously called socializing. even in the midst of an energy crisis, with the residents parked in beach chairs on their little grass patches, people kept to themselves. There was a lot of crystal light and cores. The first place we stopped, three college kids introduced themselves as Pancho, Sancho, and Nacho and said, sure, they'd buy some ice. Then there were retirees playing cards and talking about the heat, and retirees drawing makeshift shuffleboards out of chalk and talking about the heat. And a retiree couple I noticed before, the woman thin and spry, the man a near cripple with a walker and tubes up his nose, and she said, thank the Lord, his oxygen tank could run off batteries. Everyone bought our ice because they didn't want to bother walking to the canteen, and probably because we were young girls making ourselves entrepreneurial. And everyone talked to each other more than they talked to us, until we got to the last camper in that first row, which wasn't a big Winnebago like the others, but an old Volkswagen van with the top pitched for sleeping. In front of the van, there was no beach chair, only a man sitting alone on his grass patch in such a way, cross-legged, hands resting gently on his knees, that suggested that he wouldn't take a chair if you offered. He was clean-shaven and thin, thin enough that his bare chest didn't make you think of nakedness. He smiled at us, a calm, conspiratorial smile. How can I help you? We're selling ice, I said. That's smart. He kept sitting there. Do you want to buy some? Do you have some for me to buy? Tammy and I followed his eyes to the dolly. In the giddiness of our first sales, we hadn't noticed it was empty. I blushed. There's more, I said, right? Tammy nodded. We'll be back, she said, and we turned and headed down the row. When we returned no more than 15 minutes later, the man was gone. How do you like that, Tammy said, which was a thing I'd heard Gloria say. Coming from Tammy, it carried no punch. It almost seemed an honest question. We stood for a minute, contemplating our precarious, fully stopped descent to the next row of campers. The door to the van again slid open. Do you offer full delivery, asked the man. His expression was the same as before, mild and seeming as if he got a joke we didn't know we'd been telling. Could you bring it in here, he said, when we didn't move. How much do you want, Tammy asked. Just one bag. I elbowed Tammy. I know, said the man. It's hardly worth it. No worries. I'll go to the canteen myself. Here, Tammy said, but I'm not coming in. She lifted a bag off the pile, walked to his door, and held it up toward him. He didn't have portable steps like the other campers, just a 2-foot drop. That's smart, said the man. $2, said Tammy. The man whistled. A 200% markup? We could do 150, I said. I wanted to leave. I also wanted the man to like us. You know, he said, raising a long finger, I'm a photographer. I'm in the middle of holding a contest for new models. If you two wanted to apply, well, I might be able to give you a leg up. We stood there, not looking at each other. I suppose the predictable things went through our minds, the supposed dangers of men, the question of which one of us was prettier. Of course, you might not qualify, he said. Why not, I asked. Well, for instance, how tall are you? 5 feet, Tammy said, which I knew was a lie. 5'1", I said, which was also a lie. That's a start, he smiled. And how much do you weigh? 80 pounds, said Tammy. Me too, I said. What color are your eyes? We looked at him. I want you to describe them, he said. I'd like to know how people describe the color of their own eyes. Tammy turned to me. Her mouth was open. She looked a little panicked, a little thrilled. Blue, I said. Brown, said Tammy. Very dark, almost black. Very light blue, I said. Like the sky, the man asked. I guess. If the sky's light that day, Tammy said. True, said the man, true. He stood in his doorway for a minute, leaning against the silver frame, looking pleased. Then he handed Tammy $2 bills, damp from the heat. I'll take my ice, please. Tammy took the money. What about the model? I'm Galen. And yourselves? Tammy, said Tammy. June, I said. But it's July, Galen said. I was born in June. Ah, that's smart. Tammy and I named our ice business J&T's Ice. We finished the whole campground, paid her mother back, and made a profit by the end of the second day. My arms were sunburned, along with a thin strip of scalp where my mother parted my hair, and at home I suffered through dinner in long sleeves and a hat. My father looked at me askance, but said nothing. After hot dogs the next morning, Tammy and I were back to the first row again. We had not talked about the photographer, but as we neared his van again, a pressure grew up between us, a confusion that had us both reaching for the dolly handle, jostling a little. I could feel what players on other teams must have felt, Tammy's sudden and particular aggression, like a gentle dog turning on you. Until that moment, I'd assumed that Tammy liked me more than I liked her, but right then, a doubt ran through me. I was aware of my blistering arms and the possibility that my susceptibility to the sun put me at a disadvantage. The man sat in the doorway of his van again, wearing the same shorts as the other day, no shoes, no shirt. "I like your sign," he said. "Thank you," we said at the same time. "Are you still interested in the competition?" We nodded. "Let's continue then. How many freckles would you guess you have?" "None," said Tammy. 100, I said. "What about moles?" "One," said Tammy, pointing at a dark lump I hadn't noticed near her collarbone. "None," I said. "Do your feet point in or out?" We looked down, then answered. "Do you tend to bruise?" We answered. "Do you bite your nails? Will you have to wear braces? Do you have pubic hair?" I had the thought, as I answered yes, that it was the wrong choice to answer this question, that this question meant it was time to leave. I was choked suddenly with tears. But then Tammy said yes, but only two, and the man laughed gently. And it seemed like maybe it was okay after all. Maybe these were just the questions the photographer had to ask, and Tammy understood this better than I. And she had been honest, whereas I had not. Things were the same between my legs as they'd been when I was 9. I checked almost every day. "That's fine," the man said. "There is no right or wrong, you know. There's no way to measure beauty." He looked at each of us in turn. "Perhaps tomorrow we'll take some pictures," he said, and bought 2 bags of ice. We didn't go back the next day. We finished our route instead. It must have seemed to us the only acceptable thing to do. The generator was still down. Mr. Renata was close to calling in the professionals, which was going to make Booby very mad. In the canteen, Tammy's mother said the radio reported temperatures in the high 90s, with humidity at 99%. "Like you peed in the tub," she said. We bought our candy bars and went out to the shed and upgraded our dolly to a full wheelbarrow. We wanted Gloria's golf cart, but she was helping Mr. Renata with the generator and said no. "Go be dorks on your own time," she said. The van again was running the next morning, as if Galen were about to leave. "No pictures, I guess," I said to Tammy. But then the van door slid open and Galen waved us in. "It's cool in here," he said. We started to climb in, then Tammy said, "What about our ice?" "No one's going to steal it," said Galen. "It'll melt." Galen lifted our ice, bag by bag, onto the floor in front of the passenger seat. "There," he said. "That okay?" Then we were in the back of a Volkswagen van, comfortably enough appointed as living space. There was a small galley area, as on a boat, a cushioned bench, a small chair, a table that could fold up into the wall. There were yellow curtains covering the windows. Everything looked clean. Tammy and I sat next to each other on the bench, looking around, though there were few objects to look at. Galen's camera demanded most of our attention. He started shooting right away with us just sitting there, staring. We must have looked at first like deer. "Try holding hands," he said after a little while. We held hands. "What if you put your head on her shoulder?" He pointed at Tammy, waved her toward me with a finger. Tammy's head tilted onto my shoulder. Galen took more photographs. "Good," he kept saying. "Nice, good." Tammy's hair smelled of the shampoo I smelled years later on a man. Her hand in mine was cool. "What if you put your other hand on her leg?" He was talking to me. I put my free hand on Tammy's leg, which required turning my body toward her, which caused Tammy's head to nestle closer into my neck. "Good, nice." The camera clicked and whirred and clicked. "How about a kiss, girls?" Tammy lifted her head. We looked at each other, but not for long. I saw the whites of her eyes. I thought, how dumb is she? Then I discovered that we were kissing. Closed mouths, brief but still kiss. "Good. Now remember, this is a contest. What if we tried for a little longer, a little more passionate?" We kissed again, longer, like he said. I felt Tammy's hand pull away from mine, felt it again in my hair. "Nice, Tammy." I put my hands in Tammy's hair. We kissed more. The camera clicked and whirred. My burned scalp stung suddenly where Tammy rubbed it. I pulled away, then tried to make up for it by pulling Tammy closer. She opened her mouth. "Good," said Galen. "Good, yes." But his voice had slipped into the background. There was my blood pounding and the sounds of our mouths. Time passed. Galen's voice, "Excellent. And where else would you like to touch each other, girls?" And so on, and so forth. A person can imagine, can't they? Haven't you already? I told men more than once that my first kiss had been with a girl, and inevitably it gave them erections. Inevitably they asked what else we'd done. One of these men I brought home to meet my parents. "Such straight folk," he said, and I went a little crazy. "Folk?" I asked. "Folk? Who even uses that word? A really wacky kind of guy? A really totally not straight kind of guy?" We drove out toward the beach and past Schultz's, which was empty by then, waiting to be demolished for an assisted living complex. "That's where I had that kiss with that girl," I said, by way of apology. And the man looked up the hill at the old sunny campground sign. "I didn't know this town had white trash," he said. "Italian Jewish trash," I corrected him, and we laughed, and I felt in my heart all my weakness like a rag. When the van door opened, Tammy and I still had our underwear on. We were kissing each other's girl nipples, which barely swelled out from our ribs. We were saying, I'm coming," like Galen had directed us, though we had no idea what it meant. I found Tammy's collarbone and the mole there, darker than her eyes, a tiny velvet hill. I licked it. Tammy giggled, and I licked again, and I thought of my mother finding us like that, her usual blankness turning to fury, veins popping at her forehead, a great burst of color flaming across her face. The sound of the van door sliding open was like a thunder, and then there was the pokey face of the spry old woman from a couple sites down, her voice crying, "My husband's tank's not working." She'd heard the engine running. She wanted a ride to get a particular kind of batteries. When she saw us there, on Galen's bench, she gasped. You could see it register all at once, the horror, the sorrow, the shameful pleasure at the cool air on her face. In Bobby's parlor, heads hung, we waited for my father. Bobby was there, pushing pink and green cookies on us, and Tammy's mother, who locked up the canteen and now wept quietly on the rug seat, and Gloria, who kept standing up and sitting down again and shouting at us, "You're disgusting! You're disgusting!" Tammy's father was not there. He grabbed the ripsaw from his shed and sliced Galen's arm open from shoulder to elbow, though we didn't know this yet. It was the first uninstructed thing Mr. Renata had done in years. When my father walked in, you could see him take in the dusk of the room, the oddness of the company, the scent of hot dogs. "This is a trailer park," he might have thought before reprimanding himself. He accepted two cookies from Boogie, looked for a long moment at Tammy. A little slow, I imagined him saying, "but I'm not judging." And he wouldn't be. Her slowness would make him forgivable. "How did this happen?" he asked in the car on our way home. It was longer to drive home around the woods than to walk through. "I don't know," I said. "Did we forget to teach you about strangers?" "I guess." He was quiet. "Are you okay?" I nodded. We rode for a while, along the stretch of road where cattails blocked the view of the bay. I wasn't sure what it would mean for me to be okay or not okay. When we were close to home, I said, "What did you think I was doing all day?" My father smiled. "Not this, certainly. But what?" "I don't know. Picking flowers? Pretending to be a fairy? I don't know." He looked sad. "I'll confess I didn't think about it all that much." "That's smart," I said, and started to cry. "June," my father took my hand. June, he said. "Don't worry, sweetie. I won't tell your mother," which only made me cry harder. Thank you.